Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin reading with this week's Triangle Business Journal on the biz page as normal. And so here are five articles from the biz page under the heading of Moving In. New Tar Heel football coach finds a home in Chapel Hill. Mac Brown's new job has come with a new house. The former UNC Chapel Hill coach signed on to return to the school's football program late last year. Now he has a new place to live nearby. Brown and his wife Sally have closed on a 5,000-square-foot home on Tenney Circle for $2.1 million, according to Orange County property records. The home is pricey by Triangle standards. Only 13 homes sold above that price in the region last year. Built in 1922, the house sits on less than an acre, just 1 mile from Franklin Street. The home has 4 bedrooms and 4 bathrooms. The Browns purchased the home from trust controlled by Margot and Leonard Wohadlow. The Wohadlows previously bought the house in 2010 for $1.5 million. In the latest transaction, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services' York Simpson Underwood Realty represented the seller. Brown replaced fired head coach Larry Fedora last year, despite his $12 million buyout. Brown previously coached the Tar Heels from 1988 to 97, before moving on to head coaching job at the University of Texas. And under the heading of Appointed comes the article, Veteran Raleigh Doctor Takes the Lead on Rec's Board. It may have taken 125 years, but UNC Rex now has a board under female management. The hospital has appointed Dr. Ann Collins, a highly regarded Raleigh obstetrician and gynecologist, as the first chair of its health care board. The announcement comes as the hospital celebrates 2019 as the 125th anniversary of the hospital opening. UNC Rex has been the leading hospital in Wake County for 125 years, Collins says. I believe strongly in the hospital and its mission to provide outstanding care in our community. UNC Rex has proven that it's able to adapt and change as medicine continues to evolve. Collins practices with Center OB/GYN in Raleigh. And under the heading of Expanding comes the article, Saints Star Sees Restaurant Marching into North Carolina Markets. Drew Brees and his New Orleans Saints are probably still fuming over that bad call during the NFC Championship game in January, but Brees is hoping the launch of his walk-on's bistro and bar into North Carolina will have a better ending. Co-owner Brees and former Louisiana State University basketball walk-on Brandon Landry are looking to bring their gourmet spin on game day favorites to the Triangle. The chain already has put in motion deals inked for Fayetteville, Wilmington, and Fort Bragg through local franchisees. Over the next 5 years, Walk-On's plans to develop 15 new locations in Greensboro, Winston-Salem, and Raleigh. Growing our presence in North Carolina is an exciting chapter for our growth story as we break into untapped markets with new franchise partners, says Scott Taylor, Walk-On's president and COO. The restaurant chain offers signature Louisiana items such as duck and andouille gumbo and seafood dishes with voodoo shrimp and crawfish etouffee. Walk-On's is a great place to bring my family, teammates, and business colleagues, and we're expanded to help expand the brand across the nation, Breeze says. And under the heading of New Venture comes the article, Big Name in Golf Takes a Swing at Promoting Vodka. A familiar name is joining the ranks of a local vodka maker. Social House, which produces its vodka at a facility in Kinston, has named Thomas Strange as Vice President of Sales. Strange is the son of all-time great golfer Curtis Strange, who became the first golfer to earn $1 million in 1988. Thomas Strange played golf at NC State University. He's named after his grandfather, who died of cancer when Curtis was 15 years old. Thomas says he was impressed by the Social House vodka team and its focus on growth. The team's passion and creativity set it apart as something really special, he says. One of the owners, Kerry Joshi, says Strange gets cultural branding. He brings a fresh set of eyes from outside of the category, understands why lifestyle brands are important to people, and how to carve out space in a crowded world. And under the heading of Honored comes the article, Local Chick-fil-A Employee Lands on TV for Good Deed. Biz was flipping through the TV channels after a long day at the office one recent night and noticed a Chick-fil-A commercial with a familiar face. Being a regular customer of the chain's Lake Boone Trail location in Raleigh, Biz had to investigate the hunch. Turns out, the advertising campaign, which features employees from across the chain who've gone the extra mile in service, was highlighting local associate Robert Wilkins. He was recognized for stopping to help a stranded woman who was out in the parking lot, changing a tire in the cold air and pouring rain. Another man who was also helping the woman sent an email to the Chick-fil-A corporate office to recognize Wilkins. "I had no idea it happened," said David Langston, owner and operator of the Lake Boone Trail restaurant. "He didn't tell us. Robert's a humble guy. He has a strong intrinsic desire to help people and make them happy and be there in times of need. I was raised to always treat others the way I wanted to be treated," Wilkins stated. And finally, from the biz page this week, under the heading of Sports Business, comes the article, Owner of the Jerks Adds Football to His Portfolio. The Loge Box at the PNC Arena saw a lot of action February 20th during the Carolina Hurricanes game against the New York Rangers. While Biz was settling in for a quick chat with Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon, in came Bill Polian and Charlie Ebersole, two well-known individuals in the sports industry who are now tied to Dundon's Alliance of American Football, or AAF, venture, for which Dundon dropped $250 million to have a controlling stake of the eight-club league. Polian has been involved in various capacities with the National Football League, including being the first general manager of the Carolina Panthers. And Ebersole is the son of the legendary NBC sportscaster Dick Ebersole. The younger Ebersole is the founder and CEO of the new AAF and played a critical role in lassoing Dundon to fill the war chest. Dundon was seen talking to Polian pretty much the entire game, but there was another guest to the party as well, Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarlane. "I love coming to cheer for the Canes," McFarlane said, adding it was a special day because hours before, the Raleigh City Council passed the Dix Park Master Plan. "I'm looking forward to working with Tom with his newest venture and offer full support to the hockey team," she said. The Canes lost, so there was no post-game celebration on the ice, but Dundon has a few Bunch of Jerks shirts, which Biz assumed were gifts for Polian and Ebersole. Longtime NHL commentator Don Cherry called the Canes a Bunch of Jerks after an on-ice celebration February 15th, and the Canes adopted the phrase. Now, as for a new football franchise in Raleigh. Next, we turn to the Economic Development and Tech page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Lawsuit comes the article, Durham App Developer Dismisses Claim. 2 months after launching breach of contract allegations against a former executive, Durham app developer Smashing Boxes is voluntarily pulling its lawsuit. In a 19-page complaint filed last year, Smashing Boxes made multiple accusations against its former president and vice president of sales, Brian Fisher, along with his new employer, Futures, Inc. On February 19th, Smashing Boxes filed to voluntarily dismiss the action in North Carolina Business Court. Smashing Boxes reserves its right to bring similar claims to court in the future. "We didn't like the direction the lawsuit was going," John Moy, the Kilpatrick Townsend & Stockton LLP attorney representing Smashing Boxes, wrote in an email. "We wanted to step back from litigation and see if a resolution could be reached outside the courtroom. And this approach allows both parties to move forward with their business without the distraction of a pending lawsuit. We'd always hoped to find a path forward without litigation, and this approach allows us to do so." In the lawsuit, Smashing Boxes claimed it was assisting Futures with website projects. Fisher acted as a go-between, and purportedly based on his assurances, Smashing boxes continued to perform work even as unpaid invoices stacked up. Smashing boxes claimed Fisher knew Futures lacked the ability to pay, but falsely assured his employer the money was coming anyway. Eventually, Futures owed more than $250,000, according to the lawsuit. Its agreement with the company also included a provision that prohibited Futures from poaching its employees, Smashing Boxes claimed. James Galvin of Thurman Wilson Boutwell and Galvin PA represented Futures, and Fisher said, "We presented the facts to opposing counsel in response to the unsupported allegations of their lawsuit. We are not surprised that the lawsuit was dismissed." And under the heading of New Hire comes the article, New Economic Developer Takes Over in Durham. As Durham tries to lure more job-creating companies, a new recruiter is taking the reins. Timothy Downs has been named the new Vice President of Economic Development with the Durham Chamber of Commerce, the point person for recruiting projects to the Bull City. He takes over for longtime Vice President Ted Connor, who left the role last month. "I think there's a ton of opportunity," Downs said. "Durham is an exciting place. I'm still just grasping how massive the economic development world is up here." Downs comes from New Bern, where he served as Economic Development Director of Craven County. In New Bern, he also served as the Executive Director for the Craven 100 Alliance, a public-private economic development partnership formed to strategize the region's economic development recruitment activities. In his first weeks on the job, he says it's clear that interest in Durham is high. "There's a lot going on," he says. "Deal flow is pretty high. I think our biggest challenge is being able to respond effectively to all the various companies that are looking at the Triangle and staying focused. These announcements about Amazon and things like that get people off track." Downs plans to work with other officials throughout the region, saying that in his experience, talking about economic development in a regional way as opposed to a county and municipal way is more effective. Connor, in an email, wrote, "I'm thinking about the next step and pondering my options. I will de-stress for a short while first." And under the heading of Adding Jobs comes the article, Bandwidth Continues to Grow in Raleigh. Bandwidth continues to expand in Raleigh, expanding by 233 people across its organization in the past year. The team sits at 611, with new hires coming from many local and national software and technology companies, CEO David Morkin told analysts on a recent earnings call. The sales and marketing team more than doubled from 63 to 150, he said. That total includes 45 enterprise hunters and 8 strategic sales representatives. In addition, we expanded our sales and marketing team by adding more new development reps to directly support our inside sales representatives, he added, noting that technology and R&D teams more than doubled too, from 66 to 156 employees, to develop and broaden our platform and meet growing market demand. And also on the tech and economic development page from this week's Triangle Business Journal, under the heading of Reducing Stress, comes the article, Durham Plots New Plan for Bicycle Boulevards. A neighborhood bike plan could do more than get Durham residents out of their cars and onto bicycles. It could be yet another tool for economic developers working to land more jobs. That's according to those eyeing the proposal, where the Durham Transportation Department hopes to create a network of low-stress streets to help people use bicycles more easily and to safely access destinations in the Bull City. Dale McKeel, bicycle and pedestrian coordinator with DTD, explains that it's a way to make bicycling more approachable in Durham. "A lot of times, especially when you're thinking about bicycling, your first thought is to bicycle the same way that you would drive to a destination. And the roads that you would drive on are often not the ones that would be more comfortable for bicycling," he says. "One street over from that busy road, there might be a parallel road that would be much more comfortable to ride." The city has proposed neighborhood bicycle routes, also known as bicycle boulevards, that will use signage and pavement markings to better connect riders to existing trails, bicycle routes, and other destinations. Now, under the theme of economic development comes the article, So it's Apple's land. Now what? A company connected to Apple has no intention of offloading a swath of land it's recently acquired near Research Triangle Park. That's as Apple, at least right now, has no immediate plans to build on the 281-acre site, and is instead watching North Carolina's political landscape as it expands in Texas, insiders say. In the past 2 months, after news of the land sale became public, at least two sources close to the transaction confirmed that the sale was completed on behalf of Apple. What's more, given Apple's Austin, Texas announcement, economic developers were told not to expect any big expansion or relocation announcement in RTP anytime soon. Apple officials in Cupertino, California, could not be reached for comment. As North Carolina officials keep classifying Apple as an active project for the region, public records show the state, at least when it comes to the trophy prize of the $1 billion project announced in Austin, may not have been a real contender in the effort's final months. In November 2018, officials in Williamson County, Texas, must have known they were close to the prize. Notes scribbled onto a legal pad during a closed session and provided to Triangle Business Journal at the behest of a public records request detailed the potential, possibly up to 11,000 jobs from Apple, already among the area's largest employers. This would be the largest campus outside of headquarters, the notes say, detailing back-and-forth discussions of offering a 65% incentives package, must-hit goals, they clarify. As officials in Texas were hammering out their offer, sources say that on Raleigh's Jones Street, lawmakers in North Carolina, too, were hopeful. By November, they thought they were nearing a unicorn-sized announcement, as officials from Apple had visited Research Triangle Park and indicated strong interest. But in the closed-session boardroom in Texas, officials there knew something those in North Carolina didn't. Under competition, the scrawl reads, "Competing with Columbus, Ohio." In the 50 pages of public records detailing Williamson County Board of Commissioners documents from May until the announcement, North Carolina isn't mentioned once. That's as, sources say, officials in North Carolina were taken by surprise with Apple's selection of Austin on December the 13th. Apple announced an expansion of its existing North Austin campus, one that could eventually house 15,000 jobs. That same day, it announced plans to add sites in Seattle, San Diego, and Culver City, California, failing to mention North Carolina at all. State officials insist the state is still in play when it comes to Apple, though they are offering no details on what, specifically, they're trying to recruit from the computer giant. While we're certainly aware of the company's December the 13th announcement involving expansion in other locations, including Austin, that news isn't relevant to our case, Commerce spokesman David Rhodes wrote in an email January 14th. This remains an active recruitment project for North Carolina. Some have theorized that politics could have shifted Apple's interest away from the state months before its announcement, a claim that, while supported by some sources, has been denied by some state officials. A representative from State Senate leader Phil Berger's office said in December that the only reference he's heard to politics standing between the state and Apple has been from reporters. That's as a source connected to local government affairs told TBJ that both Apple CEO Tim Cook and COO Jeff Williams had been closely following developments on Jones Street and had been concerned about the state's perception as discriminatory toward the LGBTQ community. The 281-acre property that Apple acquired is in the Wake County portion of RTP and falls under the county's land use regulations. Under existing zoning rules, Apple could construct buildings as tall as 145 feet, or about 14 stories. But there are other regulations governing how much of a parcel can be covered in development, which cuts down on the size of a building's footprint. Research Triangle Foundation CEO Scott Levitan declined to answer specific questions about what could be built on Apple's property, but spoke generally about recent changes in development in the park. In an email, Levitan noted that development capacity on property within RTP is often reduced because of the need to build large parking lots. but more companies are turning toward parking garages to maximize space. In the past, economics have argued to park in surface lots, so paved area for parking has been the governing criteria for buildable capacity, Levitan writes. Recently, a number of expanding companies on RTP have opted to build parking decks that enable them to reduce surface parking to accommodate additional buildings. Clearly, a positive indicator for the health of RTP and the region. In the meantime, Apple appears content to sit on the property. There are multiple connections between Apple and Acute Investments LLC, which purchased the land in December from the RTF and Fidelity Charitable Gift Fund. Parker Poe lobbyist R. Bruce Thompson, registered to lobby for Apple, is listed in the deed for the sale. CLS Information Services, which filed applications with the North Carolina Secretary of State's office on behalf of Acute Investments and did not respond to a request for comment on this story, is the same California firm behind other Apple-connected entities. Those include Apple Payments, which filed an application with the NC Secretary of State's office in 2017 and lists Apple's executive names in its filings. Next, we turn from economic development to the On Real Estate page. And under the heading of Hillsborough Street comes the article, Developer Plans Three Tower Project in Raleigh. The developers behind downtown Raleigh's latest tower proposal are planning to do something that has proven tricky in the Triangle, build without tenants lined up beforehand. The Fallon Company Chief Investment Officer, Michael Fallon, says the firm plans to build the first phase of its 301 Hillsborough Street project as a speculative development. The initial phase includes a 20-story tower and more than 270,000 square feet of office space, along with ground floor retail. The Boston firm, new to the Triangle, can provide its own capital for large projects and is aiming to begin construction on its first Raleigh development in September. Instances of large speculative office developments are rare in the Triangle. The few examples include Dominion Realty Partners' Wade 5 office building and Kane Realty Corp's Tower 4 at North Hills, which has already inked IAT Insurance as a tenant since construction began. The Fallon Company's project is set to rise just two blocks west of the state capitol. New renderings show a tower building with a glass facade that is curved inward. The Fallon Company bought the 1.85-acre property last year from a group that included the Lundy Group and Hyde Street Holdings, paying $17 million. The company's plans include three towers. In addition to the Phase 1 office project, later phases are slated to include two 19-story buildings, one for lodging and another for residential. A parking deck serving all three buildings will be constructed as part of the first phase. The total development will be nearly 1 million square feet. By comparison, the Wells Fargo Capital Center is 551,000 square feet. And under the heading of Grocery Wars comes the article, Wegmans Triangle Footprint, to include Holly Springs. Wegmans is showing no signs of stopping its growth in the Triangle. The New York-based grocery chain has five stores in the works for the region, and is eyeing a sixth location, this one in Holly Springs. Development plans filed with the town for property south of Ralph Stevens Road show a 99,000-square-foot grocery store next to a new Lowe's Home Improvement store. While the planning documents don't name outright the identity of the grocer, the last few pages show elevations of the proposed store, which include the tan and maroon color scheme of Wegmans, and the chain's standard clock tower above the entrance. The final page of the application includes the name Wegmans in the corner, where the developer's typically listed. The proposal is part of a dual development that includes the Lowe's, which is labeled in the planning documents and would total 111,000 square feet, in addition to a 27,000 square foot garden center. The latest square footage numbers come from Holly Springs planner Sean Ryan, who says the proposed size of the building has increased, but the plans available on the town's website haven't been updated yet. Wegmans has been making inroads in the southeast, and the Triangle in particular in recent years, plans to open its first regional store on Wake Forest Road in Raleigh later in 2019. And also under the heading of Big Interest comes the article, New Office Building in Raleigh's Briar Creek Sells for $34 million. The developers behind a new fully leased office building at Raleigh's Briar Creek Community struck a $34.1 million deal for the property shortly after celebrating the project's first birthday, according to those who worked on the sale. Developer Heritage Properties, Inc. and joint venture partner Alex Brand Realty has completed the sale of the Legacy at Briar Creek building to a company owned by insurer Zurich North America. The building opened in December of 2017. Ryan Blair, Vice President of Development and Acquisitions at Heritage Properties, says the deal is further evidence of the growing interest from institutional investors and foreign capital in Raleigh. It's a testament to the strength of the Raleigh market, he says. There's been a lack of new product trading over the past 6 years, and you're finally starting to see some new product trade that's in line with other markets. As evidence of interest from outside investors, Blair points to deals such as the $314 million sale in September of a five-building office portfolio at Perimeter Park to Singapore-based investor Ascendus Land International. That sale equated to $285 per square foot. The Legacy at Briar Creek sale, while smaller, registered at $291 per square foot. The building was Heritage Properties' first project in the Triangle, funded in part by an $18.5 million construction loan from BB&T in 2016. Since then, the Maryland-based developer has been looking to expand its reach in Raleigh. Blair has been the driving force behind the firm's One Glenwood project downtown, slated to begin welcoming tenants in the spring. Next, we turn to the Life Sciences and Education page in this week's Triangle Business Journal. And here comes an article under the heading of Healthcare, and it's entitled Regulators, Patient Volumes Overstated. The denial of proposals by the Triangle's largest medical providers to expand in Wake County was based on the state's belief that projected patient volumes were unreasonable. That may be because the state's estimate of need in the county was based, in part, on overstated volume from one of those providers. On February 15th, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services released its official findings on why it denied five separate proposals from UNC Healthcare, Duke University Health System, and Wake Med Health and Hospitals, who have been competing for its six available operating rooms in Wake County. The department approves competing applications for much smaller centers by RAC Surgery and OrthoNC. The competition developed from the 2018 NCDHHS Medical Facilities Plan, which stated Wake County will need six more operating rooms by 2020. Those need projections are based in part on self-reported volumes from applicants. But NCDHHS regulators found the applicants did not comply with state statutes. A common finding among the denied providers was the belief that applicants do not adequately demonstrate their projected utilization is based on reasonable and adequately supported assumptions. Specifically, state regulators say that providers' projected utilization rates in the proposed centers, as it relates to surgical cases, stand in contrast to their historical growth. UNC, for instance, projected surgical growth at UNC Rex Hospital increasing an average 1% per year, despite historical growth rates between fiscal year 2012 and 2018 averaging minus 2.3%. And regulators dismissed Wake Med's projections of a 2.5% growth rate from fiscal year 27 to 23 due to its 1.7% growth from fiscal year 2012 to 2018. These inaccurate projections could be because providers were seeking to demonstrate utilization based on inaccurate projected deficits. NCDHHS said the 2018 state plan projected a need for six more operating rooms in Wake County based on the utilization of Duke Raleigh Hospital. In its denial of Duke's applications to expand surgical services, regulators said Duke's deficit was based on overstated data regarding growth from the provider. Projected surgical case volumes and growth rates are questionable because the applicant reported in its 2019 hospital license renewal application that historical surgical case volume data for Duke Raleigh Hospital has been overstated for an unknown reason, for an unknown number of years, the state findings report. And also under the health life sciences comes the article, Novartis-owned firm picks Durham over Illinois and Ireland. AveXis, now that's spelled A-V-E-X-I-S, a gene therapy company, has selected Durham County over Illinois and Ireland for an expansion that involves 200 production jobs. Average wages are expected to be between $72,952. The company plans to invest $60 million by December 31st of 2020. Now, to receive the incentives, the firm will be required to keep the 200 employees it already has in Durham at a site established last year to develop treatments for rare and orphan neurological genetic diseases. AveXis' initial product candidate, dubbed AVXS-101, is designed to prevent further muscle degeneration from a disease called spinal muscular atrophy. The company plans to upfit its existing Durham site for its expanding headcount, and if it meets its milestones, it could be in line for a state incentives package totaling $1.4 million. Now, under the education heading of this week's Life Sciences and Education page comes the article, Duke Study Finds Ways Children Are Exposed to Toxins. A new study out of Duke University finds that children living in homes with all vinyl flooring or flame-retardant chemicals in their couches have a higher concentration of harmful toxins in their body. The Duke-led study recently was presented to the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington, D.C., showing children in these environments show, quote, significantly higher concentrations, unquote, of potentially harmful semi-volatile organic compounds, known as SVOCs, in their blood and urine. SVOCs are widely used in electronics, furniture, and building materials, and can be detected in nearly all indoor environments, says Heather Stapleton, an environmental chemist at Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment, which led the research. Human exposure to them is widespread, particularly for young children who spend most of their time indoors and have greater exposure to chemicals found in household dust. The flame-retardant material in question is polybrominated diphenyl ethers, known as PBDEs. Couches with the chemical in its foam are linked by the study to six-fold higher concentration of PBDEs in children's blood. And finally, on the Life Sciences Education page today, under the heading of Building the Workforce, comes the article, Education Initiative Addresses Qualified Workforce Deficit. Leaders in North Carolina came together February the 20th to address what could be a looming issue for North Carolina businesses, a lack of qualified candidates. The My Future NC Commission, alongside Governor Roy Cooper, politicians, university presidents, and business leaders, announced a statewide initiative to bolster education to meet increasing economic demand. According to an accompanying report, just under half of North Carolina residents aged 25 to 44 have a high-quality post-secondary degree or credential, about 1.3 million residents statewide. The report estimates that 67% of projected jobs in North Carolina by the year 2020 will require a degree or credential. That goal is to bring the total qualified workforce to 2 million by 2030. If the population continued to grow at its current rate, only 1.6 million would be expected, leaving a 400,000 job deficit. The initiative suggests the establishment of a number of indicators to track progress, as well as the development of new programs and collaborations across the state and education industry. It's true. We're seeing new ideas and new collaborations blossom across our state. And that's exciting, stated Peter Hans, president of North Carolina Community Colleges and My Future NC co-chair. But we need to find ways to fully align, duplicate, and replicate what works, and be willing to set aside things that don't. We must focus on eliminating systemic barriers to achievement and attainment, prepare students for work, provide options for ongoing skills expansion, and help North Carolinians maintain a fulfilling, sustained quality of life. Areas of opportunity include the fact that nearly 25% of four-year college students fail to complete their degree program, as well as nearly 66% of two-year college students. Now, frequent listeners to the Triangle Business Journal program will know that there's always a cover story in each week's TBJ. But this week's TBJ is a little different. And instead of the cover story really is a salute to veterans. And this article contains smaller articles detailing five specific veterans. And this is entitled Hometown Heroes. TBJ honors the 2019 Veterans of Influence. So I'll read the opener here, and then I'll read little excerpts of the articles detailing these five hometown heroes. The American military makes a difference far beyond the halls of Montezuma and the shores of distant lands. The corridors of companies across the triangle are full of veterans and those still on active duty who are taking their military training and making a difference in the corporate world. Many veterans find that the leadership skills they learned in the military, whether honed under fire or far from the front lines, help them succeed once they transition to civilian life. That change isn't always easy, as these five veterans explain. Civilian job descriptions rarely have a clear equal in the military, and getting an employer to understand their potential can take patience. But those who've made the move from combat boots to loafers or heels say the skills they learn can convey to their new careers. As they point out, the responsibilities of a young officer, facing logistical challenges and potentially making decisions with lives at stake, can far outweigh what a young manager faces in the corporate world. So here are five men and women who have successfully moved from the military to civilian life, outline why they signed up, what they learned in their time in uniform, and how they've handled the transition to the worlds of law, healthcare, and even a car wash startup. Our first veteran is U.S. Army David Hayden, who is now associated with the Smith Anderson Law Firm. Now, these articles have about four questions that they ask each veteran, so let me just read these. So why'd you join the military? My dad was a combat veteran of World War II in Korea and was always proud of his service. He tragically died in a car wreck when I was in high school, but his love of the military and pride in military service instilled a desire on my part to also serve. My family couldn't afford a college education, so I applied to West Point and was fortunately accepted. So, describe your path to finding your current position. I retired from the U.S. Army in 2005 and moved to Raleigh. I'd been assigned to Fort Bragg several times in my military career and loved North Carolina. My wife is from North Carolina, so that provided another good reason to come back. I initially worked as an assistant attorney in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Raleigh from 2005 to 2007, before accepting a position as the general counsel for U.S. Falcon, Inc., a defense contractor in Morrisville. After years of steady growth, U.S. Falcon sold a large contract, reducing the need for full-time legal support. I'd always wanted to join a law firm and was lucky to land at Smith Anderson, one of the largest business law firms in North Carolina, in 2001 as a government contracts attorney, bringing U.S. Falcon to the firm as my first client. So, did you experience any challenges when transitioning out of the military? Finding employment after retirement was a challenge initially. There was a general lack of understanding in both the civilian workplace and among military members regarding how skills developed in the military could be applied to civilian employment opportunities. My retirement from the military lasted 2 months before joining the U.S. Attorney's Office. I was bored beyond belief during those 2 months. Our second veteran detailed is Keith McCarty, also from the Army, now with RTI International. And here are the same three questions that were asked of Hayden. Why'd you join the military? I was a sophomore at the Citadel on September the 11th, 2001. By the time I graduated in 2003, the United States was fighting two wars. I had not gone to college on an ROT scholarship, and I had no service commitment following graduation. I fully expected to enter the workforce after college. However, I realized I had the extraordinary opportunity to play a role in defining a moment for our nation and my generation. My time at the Citadel provided me with outstanding leadership experience, and I wanted to put my skills to use in service to my country. So, describe your path in finding your current position. My first job out of the Army was working for a Department of Defense contractor supporting the Air Force Research Laboratory in Ohio. I worked with that employer for 5 years, gaining project management experience in highly technical fields, and eventually rising to the position of business manager for one of their directorates. In 2014, I leveraged my proposal development experience to earn a position with RTI International, supporting proposals for their international development group. In 2017, I moved into my current role, managing subcontracts for a portfolio of projects, implementing international development activities. So, did you experience any challenges when transitioning out of the military? I transitioned out of the Army in May 2008. We were in the midst of recession, and the jobs were scarce. For a long time, my only employment came on the weekends, when I drilled with the National Guard to complete my military obligation. Still, I recognized this was a challenge for everyone at the time. One of the biggest challenges I faced during my job search is a lack of comprehension regarding the level of responsibility shouldered by service members. To me, this challenge is separate from translating military skills into civilian and professional terms. Military skills can be translated because, in most instances, there's an analogous civilian professional term. However, when it comes to the level of responsibility placed on service members, there's very little in the civilian and professional environment that we compare. Even the greenest second lieutenant has responsibility for far more personnel, equipment, vehicles, facilities, finances, etc., than most of his or her peers working in the civilian environment. The third veteran that's detailed in this article is Carl Murphy from the U.S. Army, currently associated with Get Spiffy. Why did you join the military? It was a combination of my grandfather's stories about World War II and his service to our country and local community, and my seeking the right launch pad for my career after graduating from Georgetown University. My desire to serve combined with a survey of the available options led me to the Army, and a great choice it was. So describe your path to finding your current position. I left the Army in 1995 and started a professional sales career working for large companies like Abbott Labs and Parametric Technology and small startups for about 10 years. I enjoyed sales and was really attracted to the dynamic nature of the smaller entrepreneurial companies. I found the wide range of challenges interesting and started working for venture-funded technology companies in the Triangle, such as Perivo and Geomagic. In 2003, my current partner and I started buying and developing fixed-site car washes. We saw opportunity in the large, very fragmented market of local car washing. Get Spiffy grew out of that. Finally, did you experience any challenges when transitioning out of the military? My first job was selling to doctors, which is difficult, to say the least. I went from being the guy in charge to some guy in the lobby waiting for an appointment. I hated the job and the business. It was good because I've avoided all forms of medical sales and focused more on technology and consumer services. The fourth veteran detailed in this article is also from the U.S. Army, and her name is Vicky Orto, currently with Duke Regional Hospital. So why did you join the military? To use my newly earned practical nursing license to support our troops and their families. I also had no means to continue my education and knew that I would be able to do this using the GI Bill. Lastly, my high school sweetheart was drafted into the Army 6 months before I enlisted, and I was able to choose to be stationed where he had been assigned. We've been married for 40 years this year. Describe your path to finding your current position. The Army made sure that I had all the education I needed to start RN school upon discharge. I attended Albany Medical Center School of Nursing in Albany, New York for 3 years. I then moved to Rochester, New York, and started my first job as an RN at Rochester General Hospital as a staff nurse in psychiatry. While there, I attended Nazareth College of Rochester and received my BSN. I then transferred to the intensive care unit and after 4 years became a nurse manager. I ended up spending 29 years at Rochester General Hospital, moving from manager to director to senior director and on to interim CNO for one of the health system's rural hospitals. During this time, I also attended St. John Fisher College and obtained my master's in nursing administration. I was fortunate that when it came time for me to look for a permanent CNO position, my current position was open. So, did you experience any challenges when transitioning out of the military? I missed the structure and teamwork that is so much a hallmark of the Army. And our fifth veteran in the Veterans of Influence article is from the Air Force, Joel Ray, currently with UNC Rex Healthcare. Why did you join the military? When I was in high school, I had a mentor who had retired as a senior master sergeant. He had enjoyed a wonderful career serving in the U.S. Air Force. I was raised in a small town, and it seemed like a wonderful opportunity to see the world. My parents were scared to death that I would regret it, but it was a decision that's given me opportunities for service and leadership beyond what I could have ever imagined. So, describe your path to finding your current position. When I retired from the USAF in 2008, I was somewhat anxious about transitioning into the civilian sector of healthcare, particularly that the focus would be primarily on profit margins versus service and care to patients and families. I joined UNC Healthcare at the Medical Center in Chapel Hill. I was attracted to its service mindset as a healthcare safety net for North Carolinians. After 5 years in Chapel Hill, the role of Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at UNC Rex was an amazing opportunity. UNC Rex has an incredible family culture, and you just don't find in many organizations with more than 6,000 coworkers. Finally, did you experience any challenges when transitioning out of the military? Until I retired, I had never practiced in the civilian healthcare setting. What I found was incredible similarities, driven largely by common threads and the type of people that choose to make their life's purpose caring for others. There is shared focus and collaboration to better serve patients. Now we get to the executive voice in this week's Triangle Business Journal, and that voice belongs to Hugh Sheldon. And the article is entitled, Integrity Key in a Lifetime of Leadership. So when it comes to leadership, whether in the boardroom or the battlefield, Hugh Sheldon stands on a mountain of experience. A retired general and 14th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Sheldon has spent a life in the service of his country. From a humble life growing up in Tarboro to leading squads of special forces along the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam and beyond, Sheldon has stressed the importance of integrity, character, and leadership. Since retiring, Sheldon continues to take on a leadership role as the executive director of the General Hugh Sheldon Leadership Center at NC State University, and serving on board roles in prominent Triangle companies, Sheldon hopes to instill the importance of leadership in the next generation of students, executives, and leaders. So here's the Q&A with Hugh Sheldon. What's effective leadership? That's a great question, and people have written books on top of books about leadership, but from my way of thinking, leadership is pretty simple. It's asking people to do and having them do what you would like for them to do, and hopefully in a willing manner. A leader is an individual who must be respected by his or her followers. I think the most important characteristics of a leader are integrity to start with, then personal and professional ethics. Those are the things we stress in the Sheldon Leadership Center, but we also express selfless service, trying to do something in your life that's bigger than yourself, something that gives back. I think that's an important part of being a leader, having an organization that gives back to the community. So what's the role of leadership in crafting an effective organization? It starts with a leader who must be an individual of the utmost integrity. If the people don't respect a leader, they're not going to pull together as a team. That carries over to their personal ethics, doing stuff above board, and knowing that you have a leader who will stand up for you, someone who will always prefer to do the right thing over the easy thing. You need someone who works to get individuals, even as they attempt to self-actualize, to pull together as a team. Understanding the outcome of the organization is more important than their individual effort. They got to believe they have the ability to self-actualize as they help the organization achieve their goals. As a leader, what do you look for in candidates when crafting the most effective team? First and foremost, that they are qualified for the job you're bringing them in for. Once you've got that trait, the traits I look for are team players, people who are going to work well together. I look forward to people who have integrity, people I can count on, who I know will do the right thing. Loyalty to the leader, I think, is a little bit overplayed. I want loyalty, but also an individual who will tell me the way it is, not the way they think I want to hear it. Any leader who does not cherish people will tell them how it is asking for trouble. I've seen too many people who are like that. I think that's an important attribute, that they're not afraid to tell you the truth. So how do you balance personal and professional responsibilities? That's probably the greatest challenge that I faced throughout my career in the military, and to a degree, even in the last 17 years since I left the military. I've always been guided by the principle that my faith, my family, and my friends were the most important things around me, and that I should carve out a certain amount of time for my family. Making sure that I was always at my kids' ball games was always very important to me, because I think being a dad is one of the greatest responsibilities anyone can have. If that meant working longer and harder at work so that I could take time off at some point, then I would do that. It's a mindset for good leaders to not only place family very high on my list for myself, but I have to make sure I encourage the people who work with me to do the very same thing. I think when you do that, you have a much happier organization where people want to work and want to serve. Has there been one person or one guiding piece of advice that's shaped your life? The best piece of advice I ever got came from my mother, who told me, "I want you to always do the right thing. That's the most important thing you'll ever do in life. Stand for what is right." I followed that throughout my career, even at times when I thought doing what was right was going to be a termination point in my career. So how have you stayed motivated throughout your life? My motivation comes from literally enjoying what I do. In the case of the Leadership Center, it's watching all the great students who are there, really fine individuals, embrace the idea that integrity, ethics, and selfless service to their state and nation is very important. The other thing is being a part of an organization where you, as a director, can ensure that things in the corporation are being done in an ethical manner. You can encourage them at the same time to embrace the community and give back. Now we turn to the viewpoint page for this week's Triangle Business Journal and the editor's notebook. This week, that notebook is entitled, "Apple Project Was Always Better Than Amazon's." As we figured a few weeks ago, the large 200-plus-acre tract sale inside Research Triangle Park is, in fact, land that belongs to Apple. That also explains why North Carolina economic development officials decided not to say anything, I mean anything, when Apple announced in December that the $1 billion expansion is going to Austin, Texas, despite the fact that CEO Tim Cook stated earlier in the year that Apple's unlikely to do a major expansion in Texas because of its large presence already in Austin. Well, something must have gone wrong with this recruiting effort in the waning months of the search. Now it looks like Apple wants a placeholder around the triangle in the form of a large swath of land. But the company, through its buying agent, made it very clear that nothing is imminent for that land. In fact, Research Triangle Foundation, the landlord that manages RTP, had to tweak its covenants to accommodate the request made by the buyer. The buying party will have 10 years to begin construction on the property. The standard clause states the buyer has 4 years to begin the project. So, really, who knows what may happen in 10 years? In 2028, Apple's main product could be a holographic assistant that fetches things, cleans rooms, makes dinner, and plays music. Obviously, one has to wonder why Apple would buy the land right after its big announcement in Texas. It's perhaps because Apple has always been interested in the Triangle. It's perhaps because Apple knows, regardless of its political discontent with the Tar Heel State, the Triangle is an attractive as attractive for a tech concern as in Austin or Cupertino, California. Perhaps because Apple knows it could be a huge tech player in the region, especially since IBM is now buying Red Hat, which often means the acquired company losing its decision-making leverage to Armonk, New York. Frankly, we should not care about the timing of Apple's maneuver. For one, the sale helped RTF, which is now $17.6 million richer after selling the 100 acres. Second, unless something goes terribly wrong with Apple's research and product cycle, it's clear the company has every intention to do something inside RTP. That means jobs, capital investment, and a huge brand boost for the area. And finally, as I have mentioned previously, Apple always looked like a better fit for the Triangle than the project marketed by Amazon. Amazon's 50,000 jobs pledge always seemed too big, too daunting for the Raleigh-Durham Metro. Apple's 5,000 to 10,000 jobs pledge over the years feels doable and digestible for our economic infrastructure. Hey Siri, TikTok. And this week's Business Survey Pulse is a survey about the question, where should most of the money from Wake County's hotel and food tax go? Now, there were only 42 responses, so it's a very small sample size, but there were four answers. 38% said a new soccer stadium in Raleigh. 17% said support smaller projects in the Triangle. 17% said improve the PNC Arena. And finally, 28% said expansion of the Raleigh Convention Center. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journey. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.